Hello, and welcome to Oh No, Ross and Carrie, the show where we don't just report on fringe science, spirituality, and claims of the paranormal, but take part ourselves.
Yep, when they make the claims, we show up so you don't have to. I'm Carrie Poppy.
And I'm Ross Blotcher, and we have a very special guest with us today.
We sure do.
You're all going to be excited. It is none other than Mike Cleland, a.k.a.
Owl Guy.
Owl Guy. Now, welcome, Mike, first of all.
Thank you so much.
And yeah, thanks for being here.
I think you're the one.
I think it's actually, I hate to say this, but it is in the sort of vernacular that it gets used, it is the Owl Guy.
Oh,
the
okay.
Owl Guy.
Oh,
excellent.
Fair enough. Just
like Smokey Bear is not Smokey the Bear. We want to get that right.
Yeah, we got to get, okay. He gave up his the and gave it to me. Yeah.
The Owl Guy. Excellent. All right, now I have to ask, how did you get the term the Owl Guy?
It just emerged on the scene and people just started referring to me as the Owl Guy. And I've I'm stuck with it now. If you're going to get stuck with a little moniker, that's as good as any, I think. So.
That's a good one.
I feel like we've been calling you just Owl Guy, just naturally.
Well,
so.
From now on, you will but be now. Heretofore well, known well, as yeah, so. The Owl Guy.
Every time you say it, it's just like, and it's not McClelland, which you talked about in the other thing.
Right. I wanted to ask about that.
Oh, so. That's actually not an uncommon version. There's more McClellans out there, but somewhere
yeah,
there
bet.
Was a the two clans went at it in the... you know, the highlands of Scotland, you know, many centuries ago. And, you know, one clan basically chopped off the first two letters of the other clan's name. So.
There can be only one.
Part of
we're
some
related.
Kind of fight.
So so some McClellans and McClellans, and there's about five different variations of the spelling of each.
Well, good. Now that we got that settled.
Well, why don't you start off by telling us about you, what it is you do, how you got involved in looking at owl lore.
You got 6 hours?
Yes, we do.
Okay, so I had been working in the outdoor industry teaching things like mountaineering and backcountry skiing and traveling to Alaska and rock climbing. And I had been doing that for a few decades. And then at the same time, I was working as a professional illustrator. I had lived in New York as a yuppie at a certain chapter of my life that seems so far off in the distance. I can't even focus that far back in time anymore. But so I was leading this life. And at the same time, I had these experiences as a child and one as a young adult when I was 30. And they certainly implied UFO contact.
Okay.
And I was able to talk about them, and I could sit around a coffee table or sit around the campfire and say, hey, you want to hear an interesting story? And I tell these, like, well, I saw this UFO and it was really close. And another time I had a missing time event. And, you know, so I could tell these stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I was like, I just left it there. I was like, huh, you know, imagine that. You know, what could it mean? And I dismissed it. I denied it, dismissed it, wouldn't go there, wasn't going to go there, wasn't going to deal with it. And that all changed in 2006. Now, at that point in 2006, I was sort of at the place in my life where I was like, I'm going to have to look into this someday.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's not coming up yet, but I know it's out there. And there was kind of this sense of, you know, when the teapot's on the stove, you know, there's kind of this, you kind of sense when the teapot's boiling. It's going to whistle
okay.
soon.
Okay.
And that's kind of where I was at. I was like, I'm going to have to look into this. So I went camping with a friend of mine, and this is actually sort of a stranger, didn't really know her. It was kind of a first date, which is kind of what happens in a little Western town. I was living right near Grand Teton National Park, right on the Wyoming
nice.
Border.
Love it there.
Oh, it's astounding. Yeah. So, and went into the mountains, and this, to tell the story properly, takes about 15 minutes. I'll sum it up in as quick as I can.
Okay.
In a very prescient moment during a conversation, an owl flew over us, another owl flew over us, and a third owl flew over us. It was pretty cool, like seeing these owls. They were close up. They were landing right near us. They were landing on branches near us. They were swooping right above our head. It lasted for a few hours.
You could see all three of them at the same time, you knew it wasn't the same owl.
It was a big, wide-open environment. Oh, yeah.
Gotcha. This drew your attention.
It drew my attention. So a few days later, we went camping again, just one night. The first night was without any tent at all. So we just beautiful night, slept out under the stars. And you lay on your back, look up at the big Rocky Mountain stars. Amazing. And then these owls would swoop over our faces, and just for just a half a second, the sky would be blotted out. And this owl's flying near complete silence, and it was remarkable. It was the coolest experience.
Sounds amazing.
So a few days later, we go camping again, and let's walk up to the top of that hill and watch the sunset. So we walk up to the top of this hill. We get up there, sun setting, and an owl lands on a branch right near us. And then a second owl lands at our feet, and a third owl is swooping above us. And I'm convinced it's the same three owls. We were many miles apart from where we were the first time.
And this is all at Grand Teton?
This was not technically in Grand Teton National Park. This was in the range of the Tetons. I was on the National Park side.
Okay.
So I wasn't, I was in Grand Tetons National Park, but I was on the opposite side of the line there. So,
mm-hmm.
So to have it happen once was pretty cool, and to have it happen twice kind of freaked me out, and I kind of wigged out a little bit for the next few years on owls. And so what I talk about now, and I didn't talk about then, is that when I saw those owls both nights, both times, and these were real owls. They were, 12 inches tall. They were cute. They were short-eared owls. They would land right next to us. It was so mystical to have it happen the second time.
Yeah.
And then
why do you think they were the same owls?
Just a sense. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, just my sense is that they were the same. Three owls. They looked the same. It was pretty hard.
I recognize that pattern of feathers.
No, I didn't. I didn't recognize that. But they were about the same size, and they were definitely the same species of owls, family of owls. So what I didn't talk about then, but am talking about now, both times seeing those owls, I had a distinct A voice in my head is one way to say it, but it was almost like a powerful knowing. And I was looking at these owls, and there was a voice in my head that said, this has something to do with the UFOs.
Okay. Oh, okay.
And that was palpable, clear, unmistakable. Those blended together. And so when I started researching the owls, I was also researching the UFOs. So I was talking to UFO researchers and asking them, have you ever seen owls? I was talking to shamans and asking, have you ever seen UFOs?
Okay.
What was happening is I was get these answers like, well, that's a good question. No one's ever asked me that before. And I do have an interesting owl story. So I started at that point in 2006, archiving, collecting, documenting these owl stories. And then that turned into a blog, and that blog turned into a kind of a magazine length article. And that turned into one big fat book. And then there's a second book that just came out. So this is now 12 years of kind of obsessive research.
How many reports would you say you have now?
Well, that's hard to say because I get a lot that I, you know, where people say like, oh golly, and you know, like I drove down the road and I saw an owl, and I'm like, that doesn't count, you know. And,
okay, good for you.
And then I get other ones where it's like those are home runs. Uh-huh. And what's 12 times 300? You know, so I'm guessing I'm getting 300 a year for, well, probably more 10 times, 3,000.
3,600. Okay, 3, yeah. All right.
3,000. I'm getting, yeah, so I'm just guessing. It's a little less than one a day I'm getting.
Okay.
So I'm saying it's a fair way to say it that I'm getting 300 really good owl stories a year.
Wow, okay.
And how much has this taken over your life?
100%.
Oh, you do this kind of full-time now? You are the owl?
Yeah. If you want to, so here's my, if you want to figure out an incredibly quick way to go broke, is to dedicate yourself to UFO research. Yes. So, well, that's not exactly true because I do other things, you know, so clean the bathroom and stuff.
Oh, what else do you do? Oh, okay. So,
I'm still occasionally doing a little outdoor work. So.
Okay.
Because
gotcha.
You'd previously written books on backpacking and
camping,
outdoorsmanship.
And backcountry skiing. Yeah. So ultralight backpacking and such.
Very cool. And it sounds like from what you're saying that that's often a good way to test out a first date, see if she's interested in joining you for a backpacking trip.
Well, it was a culture, you know, that's like being in Venice and saying, you know, you don't want to hop on the gondola, you know,
sure.
gondola, you know, so yes, it was just, it's just simply part of the culture.
You're a mountain man. You live by the Rockies and now you live in the Adirondacks?
Live in the Adirondacks, yes. Not quite as big as the, but, you know, for the East Coast, for something east of the Mississippi, it's pretty remarkable here.
Because if you moved to Los Angeles, you'd have a harder time seeing owls. I mean, we have.
And that's not necessarily true, because there's definitely owls all over the place. Obviously, yes. I'm living in a rural place with a lot of trees. There's a lot of owls here. But there's no problem seeing owls all over the place. They show up in New York City. They're there.
But you must get more reports from places that there are forests and things.
Not necessarily, no. I have never sort of broken it down that way. Mm. But no, I've gotten plenty from urban environments. And people will, you know, like I got a beautiful one, which is in the first book, where people were coming back from a UFO support group, returning, driving home at night after meeting with Barbara Lamb, who's a researcher and hypnotherapist on abduction experiences. Two people in the car, both experiencers. They're talking about God while driving in the car. And at that moment, the subject changes to God. Boom, an owl flies right in front of their windshield, right scares them. And they look at the clock, and it's 11:11. Now, this is, you know, so I'm going to, I have to feel like I have to, like, I'm a little against the ropes right now because you did the, you, you,
You've heard our coverage.
My presentation. Yeah. You reviewed my presentation at the Ozark Mountain UFO Festival, which was right about a year ago exactly right now.
Yeah, yeah, almost. It is.
So, and I was kind of like, what happened was you sent me a little thing, said, hey, you want to be on our podcast? And I was like, sure. And then you said, oh, we reviewed your thing. And I like said, I said, yes. And then I listened to the review and I was like, hey.
Like, right.
I felt like it was like I had to, you know, so part of the reason I'm here is a way to is to, you know, defend myself a little bit because I felt you were a little judgmental about my methodology.
Yeah,
I don't pretend to you.
That's fair. And I mean, that's part of why we wanted to have you on so that you could make your case yourself instead of just coming through our
mouths. By all means. Yeah, I had originally sent the message to you and you took note of this. I made sure it was going to get to your inbox at exactly 3:33.
You didn't do that, did you?
I did.
Oh, you did? Because that's the first thing I said is, hey, look at the thing. So
I had my email ready and then I pasted it in and sent it at 12:33 my time. And I was already, you had sent the response and I was all ready to follow up again at, I think it was going to be
1, 2, 3, 4. Or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I saw, he responded and he's now listened to our coverage. So no one had sent it to you before then.
The first time I heard it. Yeah.
Okay.
And then I wrote back to you and I did not plan this, but apparently I wrote back to you at 4:44.
And you said, that is not significant, by the way.
I don't get to. I mean, I'm in like this, I'm swimming in the waters with like UFO experiencers and people on, you know, that edge of the continuum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
So,
but it is like, a little telling, right, that Ross could just manipulate the situation, hold his email and wait to send it, and then it comes in at 3:33. Could some of the people who are sending you these experiences be doing kind of the same thing where maybe they're seeing an owl and they're adding detail to it because they're like, Michael really liked this, and they're kind of playing along?
Oh, yeah. And I'm absolutely, yes. I mean, a fisherman goes out and comes back and talks about their fishing day. You know, they're going to talk about a great big fish that might not have been as big.
Uh-huh.
So totally, yes. This is, the waters are full of frauds. And I will say, you know, this within this research, and you'll meet them at UFO conferences, there's mentally ill people. And it's a snake pit. Mm. What I do in the research is, like, I'm not giving people lie detector tests. All I can do is, you know, see what patterns emerge.
Sure.
If I hear a handful of stories that have the same flavor, I pay very close attention. If there's a one-off, I'll say this is a one-off. I have no other story that matches this one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'll make sure to say that. And if anything else, you can be assured that I'm picking one story that represents, you know, a file folder full of similar stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, and I read your book, The Messengers, and you would mention oftentimes, because you'd talk to people who were, say, animal psychics and people who are shamans and people who do voice analysis and take audio and mix it back and forth. And you would contextualize that. And some you seem to take with more of a grain of salt than others. But yeah, I was interested in hearing more about how you kind of draw that line, the threshold of what is significant.
All I can do, I mean, so I said it before and I'll say it again. Like I had a guy who contacted me. And he does his own researches, and I'm choosing not to give his name here. And he kind of gave me a hard time. He said, your research is driving me crazy. You are not scientific in your research. And I got right back to him, like, what do I care? I'm not a scientist.
Sure.
Like, who says I have to be scientific? Where's the rule book that says I have to be scientific? And these are my experience. This is my journey. I'm not documenting scientific data.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be peer reviewed. I don't care about that. I am documenting my own experience, which has been... I mean, I've lived a normal life, and then something happened. It all flipped upside down, and I have been invaded by this synchronistic magic. I recognize the difference between my previous life and this new life. This new life is hard, it's challenging, I'm broke, but I am rubbing elbows with amazing people, and there is a sort of magic in the air to all this, in the quality of the synchronicities. So that is what I am sharing. That is my presentation. I try to do it as honest as I can do it, and I try to back it all up with... So the way I... Here, so your question was, how do I differentiate? You know, the answer is I don't. Like, I'm all... Like if you went in a time machine and said, let's go back to Athens and study, you know, the source of mythology, right? So you're going to go in your time machine. Are you going to, like, walk into, like, some marble building with big columns and talk to, like, learned scholars with their scrolls and stuff like that? You know, what's the fun in that? You know, no, you want to, like, meet the guy with his, like... hair blown back and a wild expression, who's just like staggered off of Mount Olympus and is, you know, is got the firsthand experience to tell of what's going on.
Sure.
That's where I'm at.
You guess know, I'd that's... go to the Oracle at Delphi.
Well, it's interesting because you're not archiving every story you get. Like you said,
oh my God,
there's,
no.
there are some that you're like,
I don't think there's enough bandwidth on the World Wide Web for that.
Fair enough. But also, you know, you said like someone just sees an owl stuffed animal or something doesn't mean anything to you. Fair enough.
An owl purse. Yeah, owl purses don't.
Owl purse. Exactly. But then in a way, aren't you kind of using a little bit of science and then kind of cutting it off at a point? Because you are using these objective standards and saying, you know, if an owl just shows up in the culture, that doesn't mean much.
I'm using subjective standards. I'm being subjective. I'm not being objective. I'm making, you know, gut decisions in the moment that aren't based on
right.
Those are based on my own, you know, intuitive, you know, like, you know, where the I'm being pulled, you know, like I'm
uh-huh.
yeah, so
but
I'm following
but,
my instinct, not my logic.
Okay, all right, fair enough. But you are like using a standard of, does this really seem relevant? And I guess I'm wondering, like, so where does that begin and end? I mean, do we all just trust our guts about that? Or is there any role for science and observation to play in this?
Sure. You know, I like to be kind of buttoned up in the way I present it and mm-hmm. be clear about my methodology, which is just me wrestling with the data. You know, like basically I get a really good story. I'm like, ooh, I got to write this up.
I think you are. I don't think anyone would come away confused after seeing you either present or after reading your book and not knowing that these are subjective reflections and a collecting process of archetypes of stories.
Yeah, yeah. So here's an example. And this is sort of a rebuttal to the podcast you did close to a year ago now. So there was a point in the podcast, and I've given this talk a few times, and I feel like I'm an actor on the stage, right? So I'm performing a little bit, and I'm doing it for impact. And this is true. This is straight up true. This is so it's 2000. It's the, you know, it's this part of this new world history, and I have an iPad, and I can get on and get a Kindle version of one of these books, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have to wait. I don't have to go to a library. I don't have to wait a week for it to come in the mail. I can just push a button. Minutes later, I can have the book in my hand and I can search it. And the word I want to search is owls. So I get a UFO book. You know, it's $9 or something. And I search it for the word owl. And what I found is that, yes, a whole bunch of other words come up.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is knowledge. Now, I'll just go through and I was like, when I was listening to your podcast, I'm like, these guys are being snarky. They were like, they didn't get what I was saying. They're like, well, other words come up. And like, of course I know other words come up. But what I was saying is the word that comes up a lot is knowledge. So this is not empirical, like how many words in the dictionary have O-W-L in them. This is my gut. The word knowledge comes up and you do a little swipe thing on your iPad. Well, I got to just move past that. Whoosh, whoosh. Oh, there's knowledge. I got to move past knowledge. I got to, I'm trying to find owl. Got to move past knowledge.
Sure.
And that became a metaphor. Like I recognized it. I'm like, holy crap, if this was written into a script, right? And I was at the script writing table, you know, for some, you know, Hollywood, you know, TV production crew. And I was writing the script of some paranormal show. And I included this. The producer would have every right to come into the script room and give me a talking to, like, Mike, that's a little corny. Like, you're going over the top. You're being too obvious. So I'm moving past knowledge. And I've given this talk before, and I'll just give it. This is how I say it. So I move past knowledge. I move past knowledge. I'm going to do my drama voice now. I move past knowledge. And I realize this is a metaphor for my journey. I am trying to move past knowledge and trust my heart.
Okay.
Because if I trusted my knowledge, if I trusted my intellect, I would figure out a way to deny all this. I would turn my back on it and say owls and UFOs are not connected.
I think that's right,
sure.
Mike.
But I trusted my heart and I proceeded forward on this journey.
Okay, well, you've just kind of demonstrated for us sort of the path that you took there of the associations. But one could also point out that knowledge, you know, in a book about aliens or wisdom or whatever it may be, is going to be used more than
bowl.
Say the word bowl or cowl or something like that. It's a common term. If the word power if it was powler, that would have come up a lot too.
Mm-hmm.
And then we could make a deep connection about the relationship between power and owls.
But I'm saying what I had, the experience, the direct experience I had is like, hey, I got this cool thing. I can look up the word owl. And what I ended up doing was moving past knowledge, moving past knowledge, moving past knowledge, moving past knowledge to find the owl. And that was just a playful little a little thing that I recognized in the moment.
That's fun. Yeah, we agree. But yeah, maybe our determining of significance of that would be, our threshold would be at a different level.
I guess. I'm thinking like if
but
my...
But this isn't your journey. This is me.
Sure.
This is my journey.
Oh, that's fair.
It was significant to me, and that's all I can say. So there's, yeah.
Totally fair. Well, what other critiques or responses do you have to our coverage? We definitely want to hear that, and I know our audience does.
Oh, what was, there was one other thing. I could kind of go point by point, but I think that was metaphorically. Oh, you know what you did? So you said, I told a long story about my partner, Andrea, and this
the owl with the glow.
Sort of download, right? And she saw the owl in the yard and everything like that.
Right.
And yeah, that was all, you know, it's you could dismiss all of that. I'm saying that in real life, this is what happened. This is, you know, that to me, it was significant. There was the same night she reads the thing in Lisette Larkin's book, which is a similar story about a hawk. It's not an owl, but it's a hawk, but it's a similar account. And then anyway, where was I going with this? Oh, so I finished that whole thing. Boom, that whole section is over.
Mm-hmm.
And then as a little punctuation thing, right? So I did it a few times, a funny little joke, sort of a little meant to be funny and short. Like I didn't spend a lot of time on it. I'm spending more time on it now here. Is I put a little slide up on the PowerPoint and it showed a little baby owl and it said owlet.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, in the dictionary, a baby owl is an owlet.
Oh,
that's
right.
And the next slide is, that spells owl, E-T. And then I moved right on to the next thing. And that was just meant to be funny.
Okay.
Okay.
So you were treating it like it was like, wait a minute, like it rhymes
a
with
a serious
set.
Point. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And then I also...
Well,
and
I,
then
got,
I, also,
I gotta say, oh, go that does seem on the same level as looking for owl in the word knowledge. Like it does seem about the same level of relevance there.
And I think in the talk, I'm certain, I've given this talk many times, I don't have a recording of this talk. And so I usually say something to the effect of, you know, this is more of an insight into how my mind works rather than the deeper mysteries of...
You
of,
definitely... Yeah. Said that for J.K. Rowling.
Rowling. Yeah. So you... I do, yeah, and once you say it once, you don't need to say it again. Well, like when I said that, which is actually interesting because I kind of amended that now because I wrote a whole chapter about Kenneth Arnold in my second book.
Oh,
there's a whole chapter on Kenneth Arnold, the fellow who inadvertently coined the term flying saucer in 1947.
Right.
And he had a pet owl.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the start. That was the only owl reference in his, but I just thought that was amazing. For me, that was when I heard that Kenneth Arnold had a pet owl. I called his daughter. I did a formal interview. I've since talked to his granddaughter and done a, you know, and so there's a wealth of material out there, and there is so much weirdness associated with Kenneth Arnold and his story, enough that it worked just beautifully to be a chapter in this book.
Okay. Hang on there, Mike. We have something very important to announce.
Very important.
Almost as important as seeing an owl. It is a Jumbotron!
A Jumbotron?
Yes! And this one is for Justin from Sam.
And Sam says, happy birthday to Justin, my wonderful, funny, amazing husband and partner of 20 years.
20 years, Ross.
20 years.
That is a long time. He says, you introduced me to Ross and Carrie years ago, and I've loved them since, but I still love you more. Rude. Rude.
He does say sorry,
yeah,
Ross and
Carrie. Yeah, then he says sorry, Ross and Carrie, but I don't accept.
Yeah. Enjoy your year of being the ultimate answer to life, the universe, and everything.
Love your spouse, Sam. That's really sweet.
Oh.
I forgive Sam for what he has done.
That's very magnanimous of you.
Thank you. Anyway, you were saying, Mike.
I think one of the points you're making is that oftentimes we were treating something that you had said as sort of a quick aside and something intended for humor, and we were taking that more seriously and literally. That kind of leads to another question I had, which is, how do you avoid putting more owl puns into your talk? Because I think
we're both puns. Waiting for those puns, sweet owl puns.
I'm very cautious about puns. Yeah. So I try not to use puns ever.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just as, yeah.
All
Unless
right.
it's a really good one. But
you're classier,
you know,
than we are.
We
already.
You
know,
the part with of the you reason... on everything until you said that, until you went against puns. We're very pro pun.
Okay. Well, what's the problem? So if you, Kira, you write a book about owls. You write two books about owls. And then what happens is you start getting all your Christmas cards have owls on them. People give you coffee cups with owls. You should see our magnets on the refrigerator are all owls. We got owls on the mantelpiece. I've got probably two or three little toy owls in the room here with me. And those, I didn't buy any of those. They just kind of arrive. Like, oh, here we go. Look, an owl. We're going to get you this owl. Uh-huh. Cupcakes. And
That happens I gotta to anybody. Like, as soon as you get associated as the person who likes X, everyone gets that for you. My stepmother had to put a moratorium on hippos because she mentioned once, like, oh, I like that hippo. And everyone just bought her hippos for holidays and birthdays for the next 20 years. Understood. So you are now the recipient of many owls.
Yes. And I'm the number of times people say, like, yes, who, you know, like making hooting jokes and stuff like that.
Oh, sure. Of course.
But that's a testament also
to... Who would do that?
That's a testament also to just how replete our culture is with owl imagery and how often owls play into so many different parts of our culture, from Harry Potter to Sword in the Stone.
Because they're in the book. They're in the book. They were in the slideshow. They were side by side. Yeah.
All over the place. Right. What are the most annoying emails you get from people pointing out, I assume, you probably get emails all the time about Whitley Strieber's book and Twin Peaks and The Fourth Kind.
You know, there's not really annoying. It's not so much annoying, but it's more that I have to go through. So yeah, so I try to address those in the first book. I just got done earlier today. I did a podcast with Whitley Strieber. Very different tone than this one. Yeah, it was wonderful. He wrote the foreword to the second book, and he's been incredibly supportive of my work.
I love Whitley.
Yeah, he's a remarkable gentleman. So it's not so much that I'm annoyed, but it's, you know what I get more of is owl pictures on Facebook.
Okay.
And
well, so do we now.
Yeah, well, I multiply that by a million, and that's what I'm
sure
going
that's
through.
True.
I bet.
Yeah, so and my partner Andrea will be saying, "Oh, did you see that owl video?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I got it like 20 times on Facebook."
Yeah, it feels like we recognize this because we get sent these things all the time about a variety of subjects that we've covered. I assume in your mind there must be this like need to kind of stay on top of all this so you can say, yes, I already saw that National Geographic video of the owl swimming down the river. Yes, I'm on it.
Yes, I've seen that a few times. Yeah, that kind of, yeah. Which I like that video. And once was enough to watch it, but I like it. So.
Yeah.
And then walking down a main street, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Walk down the main street of our town here, and it's just like you peek in the window, and there's like, you know, owl lunchboxes, and there's a picture of an owl on a calendar, and then there's like a little owl on a sticker. And so I walk down the street with people, and I'm like, oh, Mike, look, an owl. And I'm like,
Yeah, and that's a lot of owl things.
Yeah, you acted all sad when I kind of, you know, had to give you the stern talking to when you, like, I signed the book and you said, there's an owl purse in the gift shop. And I'm like, yeah, well, you know, so I get that a lot where, you know, what can it mean? And I'm like, well, I don't know. I mean, I've got some stories that are long and complicated where things like owl purses do play a role in it. But yeah, you have to be, I mean, it's right up there with dog, cats, and horses as far as like the number of things.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm a big pigeon fan, and I'm always looking for pigeon stuff. I'm wearing a pigeon shirt right now.
She is.
But it's really hard to find pigeon stuff because they're not beloved, whereas the owl.
The dove is, the white dove is, which is technically a form of pigeon.
You're right. But whereas the owl is just everywhere.
Sure. That's like I'll go with my wife to Disneyland, and she's a big Donald fan, and there's just not as much Donald merchandise.
Mm-hmm. Or Daisy.
As there is for other characters. Yeah. It's kind of one of those things. It's an availability thing.
But you mentioned owl pictures, and that brought to mind one thing I wanted to ask you, which is all these people are sending you tales saying, oh, just as I read your book, an owl passed by the window or whatever. And I kept thinking like, oh, come on, we all have phones now.
I've got a lot of owl pictures. Well, they're not really that interesting. You know?
Sorry, I was laughing because...
We just burst out laughing because I got a notification on my phone. I was looking at my notes for this talk, and it came down with the Los Angeles Times. It says, bad news for night owls. It's hilarious. We're talking to you, and up comes night owls on my screen.
That happens to me so much. And you know, it's funny when the synchronicity, there's an interview in the book with a fellow, which is a great interview, and it's a really powerful, important moment in my life in a way to talk with this guy because he kind of validated a lot of the things I was dealing with. This wonderful guy named Dr. Kirby Surprise, who's in San Francisco, he wrote a book called Synchronicity. And it was him in a way that I said, like, listen, I'm doing this owl research. I'm doing this owl and UFO research. And I am getting so much like
owl shit,
like reverberating feedback coming through synchronicities. He said, I am not surprised. You are putting the energy out there into the universe of owls and UFOs. The universe, this is, I'm paraphrasing this other person, he told me, the universe is just a giant mirror. It will reflect back at whatever you project into it. You are projecting owls and UFOs. Both of those are highly charged. One is a highly charged phenomena, the UFO. The other is a highly charged mythic animal, the mm-hmm. owl, not like a bunny or something. And so you are putting that energy out there. You should expect that it reflects back to you. And it was a really great sort of calm me down a little bit, because I was kind of freaking out at that point in my life.
I think we would agree on the end result, but I might suggest the effect of just heightened awareness. So if I buy a gray Prius C, which I happen to drive, I now see them everywhere. They're everywhere. And it's a very common car, but I'm especially attuned to it because that's the one I drive.
Absolutely, yes. And that's another thing. Yeah, that would be the perfect example. I mean, I've talked to, you know, husbands and their wives are pregnant and they walk around, you know, and they're like, oh my God, every woman I see is pregnant now. Was this always like this? No, there's just a heightened awareness. But that heightened awareness has a power, you know. So there, during this level of heightened awareness, I was receiving amazing stories. And I,
but
so
you
I
also
talked to,
kind of put out a casting call for those
absolutely.
Stories, right?
I'm not objective. Yeah, yeah. I am subjective. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what didn't, yeah. So I'm asking for it and I'm receiving it. Yeah. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. You could almost do a little experiment where you now just say, oh, you know what? I think squirrels have to do with UFOs too. And just see
I did. There are some squirrel reports. I got a lot of squirrel reports.
Okay, there you go. And see if you get a bunch of replies with that. It seems like you might be able to manipulate the process.
Yes, but the reason I started on this journey was because I was hit with so many owl sightings.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned a connection already between God and owls, that when important conversations were being had about God, that owls showed up. We've also heard about the owl UFO or alien connection. Is there kind of a theological underpinning that comes with this that connects functionally? What is that connection?
You know, this shows up really thick in the second book. I did not plan it, okay? My sense is, and I say it, you know, just a few sentences in the conclusion of the second book, there was so much in the way I refer to it as Christian imagery showed up in this first book. And I, you know, like I'm looking for this stuff. Like I'm the guy who like watches 2001 A Space Odyssey and is looking for all the quirky connections to, like, you know, what this really might mean, what's the symbolism, what's hidden here, what's hidden there. So my radar's up for that kind of thing. And this came out of the blue. I did not expect it. All this Christian imagery, and I'm calling it imagery in the sense, and I say in the conclusion that, like, in the West, that's the core of our Western mythology. It's not, you know, ancient Rome. It's not ancient Greece. It's not ancient Egypt. Mm-hmm. Our present mythology is the Bible, right? There's all the stuff that shows up in our, you know, there's little phrases we use, and there's a church on every corner, and there's people sort of...
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot of energy put into that. So that would be our modern equivalent to our mythology in some ways, is the Christian imagery, is, you know, here. And it showed up all over the place in the book and shocked me.
Now,
and some of it was just some of the people I was working with were devout Christians, and we were working with to tell their stories.
But what is that connection, though? Like, I happen to have been raised on the Bible, and I remember owls being described as unclean animals.
Yep, it's in there as unclean, yeah.
I don't remember them figuring too much into any narrative, though.
They don't figure at all into any narrative. So there's no connection between owls and the Bible in any meaningful sense. They get mentioned a few times. Mm-hmm. The connection, I think, is the highly charged moment. That's, for me, is the connection. Mm-hmm. So the people are talking about God. They're not talking about, you know, baseball. They're talking about God. They're talking about something highly charged, and an owl shows up. That's what I pay attention to, and that's, I refer to those as highly charged moments. People at funerals, that's a highly charged moment. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, people see owls in these environments.
So if I'm out, let's say I'm out in the woods having a deep conversation, it's a highly charged conversation, what functionally is happening? Am I putting energy out, and who's aware of that? Is God aware of that? Is the universe aware of that? Aliens tuning in? Do you have any kind of grasp on functionally what's happening?
Functionally, I have no grasp on it. Okay. Like, who knows? Like, how am I supposed to answer that? What I can say is that it happens. Right. Mm-hmm. This is what I can say, is that, so I mean, I get all these stories, people like, oh, I was walking through the woods and I was with my buddy and it was night. We were walking this path that just connects the two neighborhoods, and it was, and we were talking about UFOs. Yeah, we were talking about UFOs, and I remembered Mike Clellan and his book, and I said, you know, what would be really weird? We're talking like, oh God, all of a sudden we're talking about UFOs. What if an owl hooted right now? Boom, right in that sentence. As soon as he finished saying it, an owl hooted right from the bush next to him.
Cool.
Like, felt like it was close enough to touch. So that I take seriously, like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That's a highly charged moment in the sense that they're talking about a powerful mythic thing like a UFO.
Now, have you ever noted an important moment where you are having a conversation, you think, oh, I bet an owl would come right about now.
Oh, I think
now,
it all the time.
But then
I think
it doesn't?
Oh, God, it never happens when I want it to. Yeah, so. I mean, oh. I think about when I, you know, so I know I think about that. It's actually funny you ask that because I do think about that. It's like, now is cue the owl. When's it? Where's it coming?
And then it doesn't.
You know, I'm sadly left lacking.
Yeah, so do you archive those moments?
No, I don't.
Okay.
It's not like baseball where you like, you know, where you keep statistics and everything.
I'm curious because you are an experiencer. You've had experiences with aliens.
The way I phrase this, mm-hmm. I call myself an experiencer. I even use the term abductee very grudgingly.
Okay.
Because I've had the experiences, like if you put a puzzle on the table and you put all the pieces together and there's some pieces missing, you don't have to step back very far to go, oh, that's a sailboat on a lake. I can just see it. It's
sure.
A sailboat on a lake. I'm at the same point right now. Like, I don't have all the pieces, but mm-hmm. I feel like I can step back and go, oh, it's not a good feeling to say this, but I mean, it's like, I feel like I have had UFO contact experiences.
Okay, so unpack that metaphor for me. Do you have a piece of a memory of being abducted, or it just does it just feel like, oh, because of how my life's gone, I must have been?
No, I have missing time and association with a bright flash in the sky.
Right, the orange thing.
The orange sky lit up orange in 1974 when I was 12 years old. Missing time, arrived home. My parents were angry at me. I was 2 hours late. I've told this story so many times. I could just go on autopilot, so I think it's unfair.
No, it's okay. I read it in your book.
Yeah, and then I sat up in bed in the middle of the night and looked out the window, and there were five gray aliens walking towards the house, backlit by a brightly lit light. Mm-hmm. At the time, I had the voice in my head that said, oh, yes, they're here. Now is the time to put your head on the pillow and shut down. Mm-hmm. Once again, I've told this story a lot, but now I dismissed that, but what came with that, which you can't talk about in a presentation, because what came with that was this hyper clarity that was dreamlike, but it wasn't a dream. This hyper clarity, mm-hmm. there's this palpable sense that something is not normal. Like I've stepped out of the boundaries of normal reality. I felt that in the follow-up, this is getting 25, 30 years ago now, that in those decades, I have talked to a lot of people who've had the experience, and this is part of it that doesn't get talked about. Sometimes it's referred to as the Oz factor, but that otherworldly, eerily quiet moment. And I have since had that several other times. There's an event where I talk about it in this show where I drew an illustration of it, where I'm floating up. So I have the sensation of rising up, floating, mm-hmm. this elevator up feeling, and I pass through the roof of the tent.
I remember this from your talk, yeah.
And in that moment, I couldn't include this in the talk. In that moment, I had the elevator up feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also had the exact same sensation of being in, of that event, looking out the window in Maine in 1993.
Hmm.
Now, it's happened a few more times. Once in a dream, which was very telling, because it was a UFO dream. So here I'll tell this dream. This is it's included in my website, and it's not included in the book anywhere. I'm camping in the mountains, and I have this dream, and I'm at my brother's house. My brother doesn't have anything to do with UFOs, so this is him. He's like, but my brother kind of said, you know, Mike, I got this thing in the garage. You might want to see it. I've been doing this government work. Here, come here. I'll show you what I got. So I walk into the garage, and there's a flying saucer, like partially dismantled, like up on blocks, you know, like an old Volkswagen or something. And and I'm like, oh, my God, where did you get this? And he's like, some guy had it, and he didn't want to keep it anymore. And he says, oh, but if you get too close, it distorts reality. I'm like, what? So I walk up to it.
It's like Sphere in Michael Crichton's book.
I walk up to it, and I experience the exact sensation, palpable sensation. It's unmistakable. I back away and it goes away. I walk closer to it and I can experience this. So I was in this mode where I could control it.
Okay.
Oh, weird. How big was this thing?
Not very big, about the size of a van.
Okay.
That's pretty big.
That's good size, yeah.
Yeah.
So I mean, actually,
it wasn't the mothership, basically.
Well, I've actually had that feeling too, the elevator up feeling.
Oh no, that's not what I'm talking about. The elevator up feeling was in conjunction with that floating feeling.
Right. No, I know. Yeah, sorry. Going back 2 minutes, I've had that feeling too, and for me, it was because I did holotropic breathing.
Oh right.
Where you kind of deplete the carbon dioxide in your system, and it will give you this feeling of going outside your body and floating up, and it's super surreal, and I felt out of my body. I felt like I was going to the heavens, and like something otherworldly and other timely is happening, and I did lose time. I wasn't aware of how long it took. Yeah, do you think there could be like a physiological explanation for these experiences?
Perhaps. Perhaps, but what I'm saying is that these events, these kind of trippy events, took place, all of them, in conjunction with a UFO-type experience.
Mm-hmm.
One was a dream, and I'm at the point now where, I think I said it in the talk, where I'm at the point now where I treat reality like a dream, right? So if someone says, the example I used in the talk was that a guy saw a owl after crossing a bridge. Shortly thereafter, he saw a UFO. He was on an island. A year later, he sees another owl. It's a toy owl. After crossing the other bridge, leaving that island.
I remember this one.
My homing device, my laser-guided missile, was on the bridge. I'm like, holy crap. Like, what more metaphoric, like, dream imagery can there be than the bridge? So, you know, that was the thing that I was all focused on, was the bridge. Anyway, so where was I?
You were telling the story of being with the UFO up on the blocks in your brother's garage.
Yeah, and
you could get closer to it and farther away and sort of control that.
Oh, so could this feeling. Could this be some sort of physiological thing similar to holotropic breathing, or maybe just
confirmation bias where you're expecting it and your body produces that feeling again?
Yeah, maybe that's part of it, and I struggle with this, right? So mm-hmm. I've said this before. I don't think I said it in the talk so clearly, but between the years of 2006 when I saw the owls, probably 2011, 2012, I can honestly say I spent 95% of my waking moments wondering if I had gone insane, and I used that other 5% to wash the dishes.
Oh gosh.
You know, and do just normal stuff. It was torture.
Yeah, that sounds rough.
And because I was being hit by so many synchronicities, like UFO synchronicities, and I will also include owl sightings. Those were the years where the owl sightings were off the map. And one way to think about it, and this is advice I've given to people who've talked with me, and like people saying, listen, I'm going through the same thing you're describing. What do I do? I'm freaking out. And I said, if the energy you put into it, if you put frenetic energy into your own experience, it's going to reflect back frenetic energy. At a certain point, I think I just got bored with being so frantic about the whole thing.
Hmm.
And
sure.
Just eased back a little bit. And then I still have synchronicities all the time, often having to do with owls and UFOs. But I'm not as...
You're more passive about just letting them wash over you rather than seeking them?
Exactly. Yes. I let them wash over me. I document them. I pay attention to them. I there's a fellow, he's a great researcher, amazing guy, super great guy, named Alan Green. And he wrote a book or edited a series of three books on synchronicity. And he says synchronicity is like a compass on the ocean, a compass on a cloudy day on the ocean. He is using synchronicity, and I feel like I'm doing it too. Like if you don't have a compass, you can't find your way on the ocean. So I'm using it as a way to proceed forward.
Okay. Well, going to your statement about reality being a dream, when you were having... Let's focus on that experience in the tent. You saw the light outside, the intense light outside the tent. You had that
sense. It was inside the tent.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I thought it was like flooding from outside.
No, it was a hovering mandala inside the tent. It was a circle about the size of a pizza pan.
Okay.
Somewhat translucent.
Okay.
But it looked like, in all honesty, it looked like a floating hologram of a pizza pan shaped acrylic piece of plastic, and that had a single hole in the very center.
Interesting. Okay. So let's say we had planted a camera inside the tent with you at that moment. What do you think would show up on the footage? Is this something that would be visible? Is it, you know, is it photons that are being emitted from an object that anyone, including a camera, could see? Or is it something that was more spiritually focused on you and your mind?
This is an excellent question. That whole event took place with Natasha and I waking up feeling unimaginably oppressive fear. Both of us woke up screaming.
Yeah.
We both describe it the same way. Like off the charts, unimaginable, irrational fear. Lasted for about 10 minutes and then click, we both went to sleep. It doesn't make any sense.
But until
you look at the UFO literature, and this is very common. I didn't know that at the time. I know it now. And then afterwards, this click, asleep. You know, I'm floating. I have the elevator up feeling. I look off to the side. I see the mandala shape. And then I pass through the ceiling of the tent. And I say to myself, I have to remember this. I have to remember this. I have to remember this. And at some point, that mantra, that repeated thing turns into, am I on a table? Am I on a table? Am
right.
I on a table? I have no memory of being on a table. I'm simply repeating. I made very detailed notes right after the event.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm simply repeating and going. And what's interesting is I go back to those notes. And those notes are oftentimes more dramatic. And I'm undertelling these stories years later.
So what do you think the camera
would
have
seen?
There was
a camera in the room. Okay, so if there was a camera in the tent. You know, I don't know. I don't know. Could the entire experience have been internal? You know, what it felt like. If it was an internal experience, like if the camera says, there's nothing happened. You're sleeping soundly. Nothing happened. You wake up, you're scared. Like, oh my gosh, I'm scared. You go back to sleep. Nothing to see on the camera. It could have all taken place internally. I will say, if it took place internally, my sense, my feeling, which I can't prove, it's just a feeling. My feeling is that it would have somehow been projected in. Like there would have been a source, someone with a little knob and a special little, like, you know, psychic disruptor mechanism might have been monitoring. There's a potential that I could have been laying there totally sound asleep and having a dream experience, and that dream was somehow projected into my mind.
Okay.
So I don't know, but I will say that I did wake up with a very unusual scratch.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
I was going to ask about that. And what do you think that is? Do you think that maybe is a surgical scar from...
Well, it wasn't surgical. So the scratch itself, like it looked like a scratch, right? It looked like a single cat claw or a single rose thorn had just gone from my left shoulder down to about my belly button.
And what do you think that signifies? What caused that?
I have no idea. All I can say is that when you looked at it closely, it wasn't a scratch at all. It was tiny little raised blisters. Like itty-bitty red raised blisters. Now, Natasha is a UFO researcher. She was doing UFO research in Germany. I'm a UFO researcher. We had cameras with us. We're on vacation. We're taking pictures of every cactus and every, you know, sunset. We were burning through thousands of pictures. And I a couple days later, I take a shower and it just washes off. And both of us, after it's gone, go, we should have taken a picture of it. So that psychological thing is interwoven into the UFO abduction and contact experience.
But no pet theories about what it actually is.
I have no idea what it might be. And honestly, the best answer I can give is it was put there as a sign to take this experience seriously. The same way that, you know, like a clue for me to, so I would be more difficult for me to deny that experience.
Okay.
All right.
I mean,
that's my sense. I don't have any proof. You asked me. That's my gut answer.
Yeah.
Sure.
I just thought maybe you'd think when aliens opened me up, this is where they performed their incision or something.
It wasn't
like that.
An incision. It was a tiny raised blisters. It looked like, I don't know what it was.
It looked like bug bites.
Yeah.
Or no, it was too perfect.
Allergic reaction maybe to...
It could have... But I would have... If I had been scratched by a cactus that I had an allergy to, I would have known it. It was not like a little... It wasn't like a little thing that I could kind of, huh, where did this come from? It was pretty dramatic. It was a pretty big scratch.
I mean, I had
been wearing shirt out in the sun. I would have to have taken the shirt off to scratch myself like that.
Is it more reasonable, though, to say an alien came and created bumps on your chest, or you forgot that you bumped into a cactus?
You know, I struggle with that. I totally struggle with that. All I can say is I have no memory of bumping into a cactus. And
okay.
I feel like I'm a pretty self-aware person about that thing. I know what it means to go, ouch, I bumped into a cactus.
I would remember
Yeah, I'm just
so
looking for the simplest explanation here. And I guess for me, if I saw that, I would run through a bunch of things in my mind. Oh, maybe bugs, but maybe I ran into something.
What if you had the sensation of floating through the ceiling of the shelter?
What if
you had all the associated stuff with that?
I'm pretty sure I'd have the same reaction. Because like I said, I've had that physiological feeling. And I feel like if I had woken up with something after that, I still think I would have been like, gosh darn it, what I ran into. But that's me.
Yep. No, I mean, so yeah. So I'm at a different point in my life where I've been hit so much with this stuff that I, you know, and I don't make any claims that I know. All I can tell mm-hmm. is the story in my, and you asked me a question, I gave you my gut answer.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, do you think that this could, in a way, just be like a metaphor for searching for wonder? All these sightings of owls, I feel like there's a really beautiful way to conceptualize all this where it's like, oh, look at the human mind. We're all looking for these wonderful, meaningful moments. We all want to experience wonder, and we find it.
But isn't that a beautiful thing then?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely it could be that. And this is the challenge, isn't it? You know, this mm-hmm. is the challenge. I'm struggling because I'm on the line. I'm on the line. I tip back and forth. You read the book. Mm-hmm. You must be aware that I was very cautious on how I phrased things.
Yeah.
Not to be dogmatic. The only thing I'm dogmatic about in that whole book is I say there is a connection between UFOs and owls. I say that straight up. I'm clear about that. Everything else is nuanced in the realm of speculation. I use the term it seems, it could be, perhaps. I'm surprised the keys are still on my keyboard. I type them so many times.
All right. Well, we've got to stop for just a moment to remind our listeners.
Yes?
That there is a whole new world.
A whole new world.
Of podcasts.
Yes!
For you to enjoy.
There are so many new, good Max Fun shows and a lot of classics.
So when you finish listening to this episode and you're like, oh, it's going to be another week before I get to hear Ross and Gary again.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what?
You could listen to this.
Are you tired of trying to keep up with the news cycle?
Is bad stuff happening too fast for you to process?
Don't you wish there was an easy way to find out about only the most important info you need?
Hi, we're Lisa.
And Emily. Why don't you try our podcast, Baby Geniuses?
On each episode of our podcast, we discuss a weird Wikipedia page such as
flatulence humor,
Clamato,
Catalan witches,
Slippy the Microsoft Office helper,
death during consensual sex,
and the talking mongoose.
We ask each other stupid questions.
If you got a packet with like 300 seeds in it, what kind of plant would you choose the seeds to be?
That felt like you were assigned to ask me a question and there were certain words you weren't allowed to use.
We talk about Martha Stewart, her pony, and other celebrity horse news. Ben Chunch.
Every other week on Maximum Fun.
Baby Geniuses.
To invite some more speculation on that connection between the owls and the UFOs and aliens, I wanted to look particularly at the screen memories. The idea that oftentimes people are looking at an alien, but the memory that they're left with is of an owl, sometimes 4 feet tall, you've mentioned.
Yep.
I guess my question is, why can't the aliens do a better job of disguising the memory? Maybe they could look like a normal-sized owl, because you mentioned they also sometimes appear as Jesus or a clown or certain other animals.
Sure, squirrels and deer, yeah.
Right, but they're not like four-foot Jesus or anything like that. So why are these screen memories the wrong size? Is it because they want to? Are they leaving a little wink and a nudge in your memory like, this isn't quite right?
The owls are not what they seem.
Or are they just not that great at fully disguising our memories?
That is a great question. And I've pondered that myself, and I don't have an answer. So if these aliens are all magnificent, I'd be left with a scar. Why would I have felt fear? Why didn't they just knock me out and I have no memory at all?
And why boots? Why would the owl wear boots?
Why would the owl wear boots? Yeah. So when there's very, it's interesting because there's very few reports of boots that I remember. Oftentimes these uniforms that the aliens are wearing are more like old Dr. Denton pajamas, which they're all just one piece uniforms. You asked a great question. Could it be there as some sort of trigger so that the observer is struck by something that they have to decipher? But the premise of the book and the premise of the talk is that I was confronted with things and if people want to hear about this, well, no, we don't have enough time to talk about all this stuff, but my confirmation experience was a set of events that I feel like offered me clues, and I was the only one who would have had the experience and had been able to decipher these clues, where it was dealing with maps, which I make maps. I had a psychic vision of a map. I'm being very, very cut and dry here. I mean, mm-hmm. to tell these stories correctly, I have to say, like, oh my God, I had a psychic vision of a map. It was weird.
Right.
But now I'm just blowing right through this. I had a psychic vision of a map. I had to decipher that map.
Three connected points map.
The three dots on a straight line going through southern Utah. Yeah. And what's Ben Mesnick? Who's the fellow who wrote the big hot UFO book called The 37th Parallel?
Oh, I haven't read that one.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you know, that all took place. Those three lines, you line them up, that's the 37th parallel. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about that until after the book came out. So that's kind of a little afterthought.
And that's where those three points intersect. Is that the idea?
Well, the three points it's an east-west line. So that's a parallel on the globe, yeah.
It's right. Roughly the latitude.
The 37th.
Oh, got it.
Yeah, the latitude.
Of course,
yeah.
Right. Okay.
The parallel, yeah. The other ones aren't parallel because they cross at the top of the North and South Pole. So that was sort of an aside. I feel like I feel like a defense attorney.
Defense attorney.
In the courtroom with the prosecuting attorney. Like kind of, oh, yeah. So you made an excellent point. Very much these events, these 4-foot-tall owls, could be put there specifically so people say, I saw an owl. But it was a 4-foot-tall owl. That quandary, that Zen Cohen, the person, the observer, is confronted with something that's irrational, the same way as Zen Cohen is. They have to mull that over. They have to wrestle with that ambiguity, which I think is an important human experience.
Hmm. So is it kind of like when a parent still does the Santa Claus charade, but maybe they make it very obvious that Santa's handwriting is a lot like theirs, just to see if the kid figures it out?
Perhaps. Kid's going to figure it out.
Right.
Kid's going to figure it out. There's going to be a day when he graduates from being... And that's kind of I often think about that as far as in the UFO lore. You know, like people say, oh, the aliens are from the Pleiades. You know, like, well, Santa Claus is from the North Pole, right? You know, so that's... And I can prove that, right? Because I can go to books. I can say Santa Claus lives in the North Pole.
Yeah.
They might be from the kids section, right? You can send a letter and address it to Santa Claus, North Pole. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get returned.
What do you think of other theories about aliens? Because you've talked mostly about the gray aliens. You just spoke with Whitley earlier today. He has a belief in a very specific race of blue aliens. And we've heard of many other different races and kind of an intergalactic consortium of alien species. How do you feel about all of that?
This is, you go to the time machine and go back to ancient Greece and there's these learned scholars and they have these scrolls and they talk all about the pantheon of the gods and they talk about these gods and this gods and the meaning of this god and where this god comes from and this god came from the Mediterranean, this god comes from the sky, this god comes from the story, the forest, this god mm-hmm. comes from Mount Olympus. You go to the top of Mount Olympus, there's going to be nothing there. I have a feeling if we looked through a telescope at the Pleiades, a really good telescope, and we could zoom right in onto the planet, we wouldn't be seeing tall, angelic beings. I'm saying, this is now my interpretation of swimming in these waters. We are being confronted with a mythic set of archetypes.
Uh-huh.
Lizards, angels, and leprechauns. They're showing up.
So these don't necessarily correspond to real flesh and blood creatures that we could touch or grab or chase or put under a microscope. They are thoughts and ideas and patterns and dreams.
This is where it gets murky, right? Because I know someone who has a blood stain in the shape of a giant reptile hand on their, that they woke up on their bed, that was on their bed sheet, you know? So I know people who have put out tinfoil around their bed. They were scared.
Uh-huh.
And in that tinfoil, they had giant reptile feet. I know someone who woke up, saw a gray alien in the middle of the night. He walked out of the room and he touched the wall. This guy took a sawzall, cut out the drywall, carried it into a laboratory and examined that drywall under a black light and found this four-fingered handprint. Yes, so I can't speak to the validity of what truly happened. I can only share the stories.
Mm-hmm.
There's an old-time nuts and bolts researcher, and he documented these landings. Someone would say, oh, this UFO landed in my yard, and it had four little landing pods. It landed on four little struts, and he would go out and measure them, and they would be all the same size. They would be the same distance apart. They would be the same size. A physical piece of evidence, a little indentation in the yard, something heavy landed there, pushed the ground down. There's a way to test the weight of this thing. I'm out of my ken here as far as knowing exactly mm-hmm. the details of this, but they were remarkable. Someone in Ohio, someone in New Jersey, someone in Texas, they're all getting the same markings in their lawn. Something can appear physically. There's a physical aspect to this as well as a mythological aspect to it. So we're confronted with a genuine mystery. They very well may be aliens flying on a flying saucer from the Pleiades, landing in people's yards and then interacting with them in some foggy, nebulous way. That may be exactly what is happening. That is an assumption. I can't say that's truly, we don't know that for certain. Certainly that's what they say. People say to the aliens, where are you from? And they say, we're from the Pleiades. You go to the shopping mall. You walk up to Santa Claus. Santa Claus, where are you from? It's like, oh, I'm from the North Pole. That doesn't make it true.
For example, we encountered Stephen Greer. He speaks at a lot of these conferences. And he'll say, that got a reaction. He'll say, you know, like all of these sightings and the imprints and stuff, that's all the government. And they have this technology and they're using it to kind of mess with us and implant these ideas.
Yep, he sure does say that. You know, so that's a busy government. Let me tell you, that is one busy government, because I made a little joke in the talk. I said, you want proof of this? You want proof this is real? Look at my email inbox, you know? So the government, they got to be some busy little bees to be out there and filling my email inbox as well as every other UFO researcher's email inbox. There's too much going on, in my opinion, for the government to be doing
so
all this stuff.
So that's a theory that's a little too out there for you.
Well, I certainly think there's government influence. My sense is that there's... For instance, in the book, I wrote an essay about drones. This woman had powerful seeing drones. It's a very complex story. It's hard to tell. It was actually very hard to write. So there's like technology that's right there. You can like look it up in the available literature and like what's going on in conferences and what do you call it? The trade shows, military trade shows. There's companies building drones. There's the government buying drones. And they look pretty weird. They do not look like a helicopter. They do not look like an airplane. They're flying around. The $39 ones you get at Toys R Us look weird. They fly around like a little, you know, they hover with an eerie smoothness. People are reporting. I suspect that a vast number of the present day, you go back 100 years, it doesn't count, right? Because there's no drones. Present day UFO reports are a mess because there are so many man-made objects that can mimic what we once would have called UFOs.
Puts the U right in UFO. All it has to be is unidentified, right?
Yeah, exactly. So yes, it's a UFO. In fact, it's unidentified, though the source might not be Zeta Reticuli. The source may be
Toys R Us.
Toys R Us. Or, you know, if you want to get more elaborate, you know, there are military applications for these. And I understand that. Mm-hmm. I understand why they'd want to keep it secret. So, yes. So I think that there's the military aspect of the UFO issue is its own mess. And I'm certain that it's muddled and mixed up.
Mm-hmm. Well, are there any theories that are too far out there for you in the UFO community?
I have a real hard time with David Wilcock and what's his buddy's name on Gaia TV.
We definitely know of David.
We know David. Yeah, I'm not sure who the other guy is.
Oh, do you know him personally?
No,
but
we've seen him at a conference in California.
Okay.
We reported on him too.
Yeah, I'm very dubious of some of his claims. You know, he's a great presenter. He's a skilled orator. He's a dynamic presence, charismatic presence, but that doesn't make it true.
Yeah, we're right there with you.
Yeah, so but what about that strikes you? What gets your skeptical haunches up there?
You know, honestly, he's just because he's just got too much of it. You know, like how do you he's saying too much. It's 1, 2, 3, 4. We've just done it's 12:34. So 1 hour, 12 minutes and 34 seconds. Just went past my time clock there on the phone.
Oh.
So I was watching it. I was kind of...
Oh, yeah.
yeah, I don't... I mean, I think it's too tidy. It's like it's too wonderful, his presentations. That's my concern.
Tidy is not what I would have called David Wilcock.
it's a mess when you try to, you know, when you try to make sense of it, you know, but his, you know, he's capable of... He's a good pitchman. Something that I'm not going
to
buy.
But, you know, listening to him back to back with someone like Stephen Greer, only one of them can be right. They can't both be right.
They can both be wrong, though.
Yes.
That's right.
That's true.
Here's my Stephen Greer story. I was at a conference and I was talking with a UFO researcher or crop circle researcher, Colin Andrews. Colin was close friends with Stephen Greer. I don't think I'm saying anything out of sorts here. I've talked to many old-time researchers and I brought up Stephen Greer and they all say, you know, he was a real dynamic character back in the day and he was really fighting the good fight. And they all imply like something happened, whether he went off the deep end or he just got too involved in his own ego or something. I'm not saying anything that isn't like openly talked about in right. UFO circles.
So. Mm-hmm.
And Colin Andrews is an old friend of Stephen Greer's. And he, mm-hmm. they had a UFO conference. I'm talking with Colin Andrews. Colin looks over my shoulder. Just before he looks over my shoulder, I go, we're outside and I get a little tickle in the back of my throat, and I watch this little bug, and he like looks at me, and Collins kind of laughs. He said, I just watched a mosquito, his English mosquito, go into your throat there. So I hear him look over my shoulder. He says, Stephen. And he looks, and Stephen Greer walks up and he introduces me, and I can't speak. I'm totally mute.
Oh,
I'm absolutely 100% mute.
What?
Stephen Greer is standing there. He talks the most banal kind of like, well, my flight was a little late. I got to check into the hotel. I'm going to walk up to my room. We should get together. Yeah, let's, you know, so he's talking to, I'm completely excluded from the conversation. I can't talk. And then he walks away and I go, and I watch a little teeny dot of a mosquito shoot out of my cough, and I have my voice back.
Oh. Uh-huh.
So what do you think was going on?
It felt so funny. I was not going to like tell Stephen Greer to his face like he's a big fat, you know, show off or something like that. I wouldn't have said that.
That wasn't Stephen Greer exercising power over you through this mosquito. This was something.
No, I don't think so.
Something else stopping you from speaking to him.
Yes, there was a little mosquito that stopped me. It could have been nothing other than a coincidence.
So, were you opening your mouth and trying to speak?
Yeah,
it was and like a. Were little, they like reacting a, to that? I feel like if I saw.
No,
someone...
I was polite enough to realize, like, I would have, you know, I wasn't choking, so I didn't have uh-huh. to, like, you know, I was breathing fine.
Uh huh.
So that has never happened to me ever,
and it before happened, or since
it lasted all of 3 minutes, maybe, and then it
interesting.
Was in Stephen Greer's presence. I don't know what to make of it.
Wow,
it's a funny story. That's what I can make of
it. Okay,
I have a funny story.
Fair enough. Well, one other question, just by way of follow up from things I think you'd mentioned in your presentation and in the book, you talked about I think a couple people who had downloads where they felt like they had received really important, deep information before or after near an owl sighting, and they said they would find out at a later date. Kind of yep. what that meant. Have you ever heard back on any of those accounts? What those downloads
were? Well, Andrea is right downstairs, and she doesn't know. She's right here. She had that. You're talking about Andrea's experience.
Yeah,
there's a woman named Jessica. I haven't followed up with Jessica, but I will tell you that this is straight out of the UFO literature. That people will be in the presence of an alien, and they'll be like, oh, "I just got a download," and then they'll say, "What it was?" And they'll say, "I don't know."
They'll have the sense of profundity, but but without the content of that profundity.
Absolutely. That is consistent. And this is also something consistent where the sense of mission, it's right. You go to a UFO questionnaire. You can look these up online. There's dozens of them. I went through a kind of crazy obsessive phase where I downloaded all these. I wanted to put them on a spreadsheet. And it was too mammoth of a project. In compare and contrast, every UFO researcher, here, take my little questionnaire. So you got dozens of UFO researchers researching abduction in particular. And here's my questionnaire. Just fill this out. It's usually about 20 questions. Some of them are hundreds of questions. One of the questions shows up on all of them. Do you have a sense of mission? And this is, you talk to people who've had the UFO contact experience. You ask them this. I'm serious. You ask them like, hey, just on a scale of 1 to 10, what's your sense of mission? The answer I get most often, they'll kind of like squint there or kind of scrunch up their face and go, can I say 11? And then I said, what's your mission supposed to be? And like, I don't know. So there's this crazy urgency that comes, and maybe there's crazy urgency that comes with schizophrenia or other types of mental illness. So I'm open and aware of that. But all I can say is that within the UFO sort of circus of people who had these experiences, there's a sense of urgency. There's a sense of mission that feels strong, and they don't know the source.
Have you compared that to people outside the UFO community?
What's your sense of mission? On a scale of 1 to 10, what's your sense of mission?
Oh, you know, as soon as you said that, I thought like, well, I would give that a really high rating.
I'll say 9.
Yeah, 10, 11. Ooh. I mean, yeah.
Oh, right on. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, don't you think that like most people probably feel like they're here for a reason?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm in my own little bubble. Don't listen to me in the sense of like, you know, whether this is true or not. You know, all I'm saying is that this is, I'm looking for the patterns. I'm stuck in my own little bubble, right? You know, so yes, you can, you could dismiss my Clellan easy just because I'm so quirky and obsessive about my own research.
Well, I'm not asking it to dismiss you. I'm asking it to understand where you're coming
perhaps,
from.
Perhaps, yeah. I've never done it. So the question was, have I ever done an outside thing, like a control group? And I haven't.
Okay. Fair enough.
And some researchers have, though. I will say some researchers have, and that would be an interesting one to talk about.
Yeah, totally.
But I don't have the answer right off the bat.
But fair enough.
We appreciate you coming on our show and being a really good interlocutor.
Yeah,
and a good sport, and being generous with your time. We also wanted to tell our listeners that we've agreed with Mike. He's going to send us 20 copies of his book.
Signed.
That we're gonna buy from him. And we want to give them to you, the listeners. And I'm going to ask one thing, just that you enter this contest if you do really want to read the book.
Yeah.
That'd be my one proviso. And what we're going to do is we're going to have anybody submit, say, a poem.
How about a piece of art?
A piece of art. And that could be a poem or a piece of art showing your passion for owls or maybe something related to this conversation.
Yeah.
And
could be a haiku, could be a painting, could be a short story, whatever.
And so what we'll do is after this interview comes out, we'll put up a thread on Facebook, send us your artwork, and we'll take our time. So you don't need to do it right away, but we'll announce the deadline and we'll look through those and kind of in our own subjective way, choose the winners. We'll send out 20 copies.
And if you don't have Facebook, you can send them to info@onopodcast.com.
Warning, I may borrow one of those copies first to read it.
Hey, so I could send you, we'll talk about this afterwards, but I could send you a mix of the first book, which came out a couple of years ago, which you have, The Big Blue Book.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be great. Yeah.
And then the new book, which is green.
Okay.
Yeah. So do you feel like people need to have read the first one to appreciate the second one?
No. No, you can read them in either order.
Okay.
And but they do companion. Yes, they're nice companions.
Yeah, they complement each other.
Fit next to each other on the shelf.
In any order.
Okay, yeah. You know, send
us. Hey, here's now what I'm going to ask you. This is now I'm going to hold you to the fire. Here
okay, good.
Do it.
What'd you think of the book?
Well, Ross read the whole thing. I've read probably 100 pages.
Okay.
I appreciated the unpacking of the ideas. And I think I came away feeling, as we've discussed in our conversation, that you have a different threshold of significance that you'll apply to certain inputs. And yeah, I thought it was entertaining and interesting. I would say my only critiques were just that certain inputs were allowed into the narrative that I would have been dismissive of, more dismissive of, say, like, you know, the person who did the audio masking, the back masking.
Oh, that guy's great, though. I like that guy.
Okay.
I mean, this guy is a wonderful guy, and he takes it very seriously. So, you know, what I would say is go do a session with Wayne Nicholson.
Oh, gladly. Where's he located?
In upstate New York, yeah.
Okay.
So, fairly close by to me, yes.
I find all your work.
I'll remain silent, but yes, Wayne Nicholson is a marvelous, marvelous fellow, and he is way out there on the edge, and at the same time, he is so grounded in the way he approaches it, so... And that's my opinion, but
sure,
you should have him on the show. Do a session with him.
Oh, we'd gladly do a session with him.
I don't think I
so
know.
So you'd have what you would have to do is then do a reverse speech analysis.
So what he'll do is he'll have a conversation with you and he'll ask you specific questions.
He'll just say, "Talk, go ahead, talk, keep talking. What do you think about this?" And he's partially a therapist. You can hear that in his voice.
And then he analyzes those recordings and he'll play sections of audio backwards and find hidden messages in what you've said.
Oh, like you Paul said, is dead kind of situation.
Right. You said forward.
Exactly. I agree.
I find myself in the woods often. And then when you play that backwards, he'll say, you were saying the owls are listening.
Okay. Got it.
Was that in there? I don't think that was in there.
That is me making up an example.
Yeah, that's
of
close,
the sort
though.
Of thing.
That's close, though. Yeah.
Yeah, I find all your work really charming, Mike. I guess the sense I keep getting is that, in a sense, you want to have it both ways a little bit. Like, here are all these theories, but if you nail me down on the theories, I didn't really mean them. So that would be my one critique. But it's so charming. And like I said, I see it as this just sort of human search for wonder. And when I see people looking for wonder and finding it, to me, that's a really heartening, lovely thing. So that's the lens through which I see all your work.
And we'd both heartily agree that you're an earnest guy. You're telling the truth. You're not out to deceive or pull the wool over anybody. You're just seeing the world the way you do.
Or the feathers.
I might come up with different explanations for the things you encounter, but it's fascinating to hear your explanations.
Fair enough. As I said before, the only thing I said with absolute concrete declaration in the book is that there is some connection between UFOs and owls.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, it is all a form of speculation.
Right.
Fair
yeah.
enough.
Even that's a big claim, though.
I feel it in my bones, having been immersed in it this much. So I feel strongly. I got no problem making that claim.
Okay, good. Well, that's it for our show. Our thanks to Mike Cleland for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much. Our theme music is by Brian Keith Dalton. Our administrative manager is Ian Kramer.
You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/onrac, O-N-R-A-C. And that's also where you can submit for our book giveaway.
Yeah. You can also follow us on Twitter if you like birds. And we are Oh No Podcast there.
Yeah. And remember.
So after all my time doing this, I have been obsessively focused on things at the outer edge. What I have found is that it's good energy spent stepping off the main path. It's a powerful experience to step off the path and into the darkest part of the forest where there is no trail. For me, that has been enormously, enormously rewarding, and my life is different now. When I started this stuff, I was kind of in a panic about it. I wrote in one essay somewhere along the lines, I said, the owls pushed me off a cliff. And someone kind of like was helping with text and stuff. And she kind of said, isn't that a little heavy handed? Like, do you really want to say that? I'm like, yes, I really want to say that. So the owls pushed me off a cliff. My direct owl experiences left me adrift. The normal stuff that was all my world, I had to swim beyond that into the deeper waters. And it has been challenging, but also in a wonderful way, it has been extremely rewarding.
Hey, Helen Hong.
Yes, J. Keith Van Stratton?
What's the difference between a layover and a stopover?
I have no idea. What's the difference between optimal and optimum?
I have no idea. Well, what's the difference between an actual conversation and a promo for our new show on Maximum Fun, Go Fact Yourself?
Nobody has any idea.
Go Fact Yourself, the game show with celebrity contestants, super smart experts, and answers to questions you've never even asked.
Listen twice a month on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And be in the audience for our tapings of Go Fact Yourself in downtown LA. It's free. Go to GoFactYourPod.com for more info.
We're having a very realistic conversation.
Yes, we are.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.